This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Age of Autism, Mercury, Medicine, and As Man-Made Epidemic. Written by Dan Olmsted and Mark Blaxall. Narrated by Paul Bamer. Forward. When it came to collecting quicksilver, the ancient Romans would send condemned criminals and slaves into the mercury mines to extract the poisonous metal from the earth's crust. The work, so gruesome and hazardous, the miners would soon die a crazed and anguished death, was considered unsuitable for even the lowest classes of Romans. But once it was mined, the Romans had no qualms about using the powerful neurotoxin for medicine and other purposes. They would have been far better off leaving the stuff in the ground. Humans have always been exposed to limited amounts of naturally occurring mercury from, say, volcanic eruptions, spring water, or fish. Over the millennia, these low-level exposures have spurred the development of natural defenses, called mercaptans, from the Latin for capturing mercury, that bind with heavy metals and eliminate them from the body. But then, humankind began to mine mercury, drawing it up from the rocks below and using it for all sorts of strange purposes. Mercury, the second deadliest element on Earth after plutonium, of course, does not break down, dissolve, or turn into something else. Instead, it accumulates in our food, air, and water. Although we may laugh at the Romans for being so ignorant as to use mercury in medicine and lead in water pipes, the risky and unnecessary practice continues to this day. Worldwide mercury exposures have been skyrocketing in the last decade or so and dwarf anything seen in the time of Dickens and the Industrial Revolution. American lake beds reveal astronomical levels of the metal in recently settled sediment. Small fish and even songbirds are turning up with high levels of mercury contamination, which was hitherto the sole province of top-of-the-food-chain predators. Mercury deposition rates rise each year, much of the mercury coming from coal burning in the Far East, whose metal-laden emissions cross the Pacific and settle into North America in the form of rain fallout, only to be kicked up again into the atmosphere by raging wildfires near increasingly populated areas. All of this background mercury means that our own personal levels are rising as well. People might poke fun at the actor Jeremy Piven and his claims of quicksilver toxicity via a diet heavy in sushi, but consider this. A new study has shown that inorganic mercury was detected in the blood of 30% of U.S. women in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. CDC's most recent National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, NHANES. That figure was 1,500% higher than what was reported in the 1999-2000 survey, when only 2% of women had inorganic mercury in their blood. No one knows the exact effect of these rising mercury exposures in people, and especially in pregnant women and their unborn children. But we do have some idea. Mercury can ravage the immune system, trigger autoimmunity, attack mitochondria, the batteries inside cells, increase oxidative stress, activate brain cells called microglia, spark chronic neuroinflammation, and block production of glutathione, the body's most powerful mercaptan that protects us from mercury in the first place. And all of these problems can be found in at least some children with autism. Today, 1 in 6 American children is born with mercury levels in their blood that are high enough to cause neurodevelopmental deficiencies later on in life. Perhaps coincidentally, or perhaps not, the same number of American children will go on to develop a learning disability, and 1 in 100 will develop an autism spectrum disorder, ASD. These poor kids are born already set up for neurological failure. Many of them are already at the exact toxic tipping point when it comes to prenatal and neonatal exposures to toxic metals. So why on earth would we inject them with vaccines containing organic ethyl mercury and aluminum salts beginning on day one and repeated at regular intervals over the next couple of years? There is now ample science to tie mercury toxicity to autism, just as there are historical examples to tie mercury exposure to what appears to be mental illness. After all, Mad Hatter's disease was an affliction of the felt trade, which used copious amounts of mercury in its production. And just outside Phoenix, you will find the defunct cluster of Dreamy Draw Mercury Mines, so-called because of the mildly psychotic state in which the miners emerged from their shafts. Today, it is the site of the Mercury Mine School. In the following recording, Dan Olmsted and Mark Blacksill, two men I consider friends, colleagues, and patriots, walk us through humankind's disastrous dalliances with mercury over the centuries, leading us inexorably toward our own new and unsettling age of autism. One very disturbing trend emerges in this audiobook, and that is the ignorance and arrogance of medical professionals who have insisted, over the years, that mercurials in medicine could treat or prevent the onset of horrible, disfiguring diseases, while utterly ignoring or dismissing the evidence that their medicine was often doing more harm than the diseases it was designed to fight. Whether the problem was syphilis or teething pain, doctors often prescribed mercury. As Olmsted and Blacksill so eloquently describe, this blind belief in a known poison was misguided, immoral, and in some cases, patently criminal. Mercury, they argue forcefully and convincingly, is found at the root of many plagues of the industrialized world, from the lunacy of Dickens's coal-choked England to Freud's hysterical Viennese women, to the collection of symptoms we now call autism spectrum disorders. In each case, the metal left behind its insidious footprints. Olmsted and Blacksill have done a masterful job of retracing these clues through an encyclopedic history of metal-induced madness. Can toxins trigger plagues? They can. Autism is a man-made disease, Olmsted and Blacksill warn us. But that is cause for hope. By cracking autism's code and revealing its underpinnings, we may solve the mysteries lurking behind many modern-day scourges, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Lou Gehrig's disease. Anyone concerned with environmental health owes it to him or herself, and to the world, to listen to this revolutionary book. David Kirby. Where observation is concerned, chance favors only the prepared mind. Dans le champ de l'observation, le hasard ne favorise que les esprits préparés. Louis Pasteur, 1854. Introduction. The seed. You are not to expect visible proofs in a work of darkness. You are to collect the truth from circumstances and little collateral facts, which, taken singly, afford no proof, yet put together, so tally with and confirm each other that they are as strong and convincing evidence as facts that appear in the broad face of day. Judge Francis Buller, to the jury in a murder trial. 1781. When we decided to investigate the natural history of autism, we never meant to dig so deep. We simply wanted to trace the rise of the disorder, beginning with a landmark 1943 report by Johns Hopkins psychiatrist Leo Kanner on 11 anonymous children born in the 1930s. But right from the start, we discovered more than we bargained for. No one, it seems, ever tried to identify those original children and their families. No one looked past the patterns recited over and over. Those first parents were highly educated. They were atypically affluent, Many of them had medical and scientific backgrounds, mothers included. From those observations based on limited data, it was just a wrong turn or two to the idea that something was wrong with these families. The fathers and mothers were labeled aloof and career-obsessed. They were refrigerator parents. Their cold indifference to each other and their own offspring drove these children into the empty fortress of autism. In Kanner's words, most of the fathers are, in a sense, bigamists. They are wedded to their jobs at least as much as they are married to their wives. The job, in fact, has priority. Once the idea that parental coldness had promoted autism in their children was abandoned, scientists turned to their genes. Autism is one of the most heritable, complex genetic disorders in psychiatry, reported a respected academic journal in 2003. But we unearthed something different, something that did not point to mutant genes or malignant parenting. We decided, instead of taking Kanner's word for it, to learn about these previously anonymous families ourselves. We took clues from his extensive case descriptions and started uncovering the identities of the original families. Time and again, we connected the occupations of the parents to plausible toxic exposures, and especially to a new mercury compound first used in the 1930s as a disinfectant for seeds, a treatment for lumber, and a preservative in vaccines. Yes, the parents' professions were clues, but not to their obsessions, or their marriages, or their parenting, or their genetic oddities. Instead, they pointed to a strikingly consistent pattern of familial exposures to the same toxic substance. This discovery is something entirely new. While debate has raged, inconclusively, over whether mercury in vaccines was responsible for the explosion in autism diagnoses beginning in 1990, we saw the seeds of autism planted one by one, family by family, 6 decades earlier. This led to a deeper question than the one we'd originally sought to answer, namely, were clues like this missed before? Was mercury the buried seed that gave rise to other disorders, disorders that seem different but fit into the same pattern of misdiagnosed mercury exposure? Once again, the answer our investigation supports is yes. Different kinds of mercury and different exposures can cause a variety of disorders, often delayed and disguised. We need to assign mercury to the illnesses it causes. Eric Gladden of the World Mercury Project told us, "That hasn't happened, and I don't know why." Our research uncovered a hidden history of mercury poisoning, a history that needs to be exposed before it can be put to an end. For centuries, mercury use was widespread in medicine, and the consequences were disastrous. The greatest plague of Europe and America, spanning 500 years, was syphilis, and the standard of care, the generally accepted medical treatment of the time, before penicillin, was mercury. Our investigation has led us to believe that a man-made mercury compound, interacting with syphilis itself, caused the horrendous affliction called general paralysis of the insane. This illness, also called GPI, is a classic instance of the synergistic dangers of metals, microbes, and man. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people in medically advanced countries suffered and died as a direct result, while doctors ducked or missed the truth, clearing the way for subsequent catastrophes. In 19th-century Vienna, several of the key cases of so-called hysteria seen by Sigmund Freud were actually instances of mercury poisoning, we argue. Young women of this time were expected to care for sick relatives, often treating their own fathers with mercury for syphilis. Men, too, succumbed to mercurial medicine or workplace exposure and were also labeled mentally ill. These erroneous diagnoses sent psychiatry off on several tangents, blaming parents for all kinds of mental disorders and concocting elaborate psychosexual theories of mental illness. The Freudian tendency to link hysterical mental disorders to childhood psychic trauma may have been one reason medical experts later missed the environmental cause of autism. In acrodynia, or pink disease, an illness that would foreshadow autism, teething powders and other over-the-counter nostrums containing mercury poisoned untold thousands of children. Hundreds died. The cause remained a mystery for decades. In addition, the heroic use of mercury in the United States may have given rise to all kinds of chronic health problems, including a 19th-century collection of symptoms called neurasthenia. Medicine was not the only source of mercury exposure. England's coal-fired industrial revolution spewed tons of mercury, lead, and arsenic into the atmosphere for the first time in history, a surge that correlates with a baffling explosion of severe mental illness. As manufacturers stepped up the use of mercury compounds, accidents and excesses led to environmental catastrophes like Minamata disease in Japan, and to a spike in autism cases in a district next door. We suspect today's ever-expanding coal pollution, combined with thousands of new environmental contaminants, continues to fuel mental, physical, and neurological problems that no one can figure out, let alone cure. Studies suggest American children have a higher risk of autism the closer they live to coal-fired plants. We believe that autism was newly discovered in the 1930s for the simple reason that it was new. The organic chemicals industry that grew out of chemical warfare research during World War I led to new commercial uses for mercury, including the introduction of some extraordinarily toxic compounds made from ethyl mercury. This, our research suggests, led directly to the first cases of autism. Among the parents of those first 11 cases described in 1943, you will meet a plant pathologist experimenting with ethyl mercury fungicides in Maryland, a pediatrician in Boston who was an early champion of mass vaccinations containing ethyl mercury, and a stenographer in a pathology lab in Washington, D.C., who spent her workday exposed to mercury fumes while her future husband, a psychiatrist, treated syphilis with mercury just as Freud had done decades earlier. Several other families cluster around the medical profession, agriculture, and forestry, the three biggest risk factors for exposure to mercury in its newest and most toxic form. Leo Kanner provided some clues to the backgrounds of these early parents, such as their professions, but our investigation uncovered dramatic new details about what the parents were doing when each child was born and in the critical years before that. By the time our 5-year journey was done, we had worked our way through newspaper clippings, professional archives, city directories, cemetery records, ancestry searches, last known addresses, and libraries from Washington, D.C. to Moscow, Idaho. We found and interviewed family members of several of the first 11 children. Most memorably, we met two of those cases ourselves. At the end of our search, we talked with Case 1, Donald T., around the kitchen table in his lifelong home in the small lumber town of Forest, Mississippi. By any measure, he has fared astonishingly well. President of his college fraternity and later the Forest Kiwanis Club, a pillar of his Presbyterian church, he had a long career at the local bank, plays a competitive game of golf, and regularly travels the world. We learned how Donald T. went from being the first unmistakable case of autism to the first unmistakable case of recovery. He also reminds us how recent autism is, the space of one man's lifetime. Donald T. turned 77 in September 2010. Leo Kanner's original cases, linked only by this overlooked association with mercury, suggest that from the very beginning, autism was an environmentally induced illness, a toxic injury rather than something inherited or inculcated. Certainly, Some children were more susceptible to mercury exposure, and that may implicate genetic vulnerabilities. This is very different, however, from saying that autism is an inherited genetic disorder. Tragically, the best and the brightest in science and medicine have missed these clues from the start, blinded first by the belief the parents were responsible, and then by their ongoing pursuit of the autism gene. The great autism gene hunt has come up empty, but continues to drain off millions of dollars and thousands of hours that should go to more promising environmental research. Having thoroughly failed to solve the autism puzzle, the medical industry is putting forth a new wave of epidemic deniers to claim autism isn't really increasing after all. Simply put, this idea is nonsense, and sadly, it prolongs the epidemic and prevents the urgent response this public health crisis demands. In tracing the history of autism, we cannot avoid discussion of what we have already acknowledged as a controversial topic: vaccines. Some critics have labeled us anti-vaccine for even broaching the subject. But our interest has more to do with vaccination as a risk factor, perhaps one of several. We want to state explicitly that we support vaccines as long as they are individually and collectively tested for safety and not deployed excessively as part of an overall policy to promote childhood health. We are not anti-fungicide or anti-vaccine or anti-anything, but autism. We support progress and innovation. Mercury was removed from fungicides in the 1970s for safety reasons after several episodes of mass poisoning. We don't want crops to wither or houses to rot or children to die of vaccine-preventable illnesses. We simply want to stop an autism epidemic whose origin we believe can be discerned from a careful examination of its environmental history. Vaccines have played an important role in public health, from the eradication of smallpox to the near eradication of the rubella virus that can cause fetal harm, as we outline in Chapter 7. But too many vaccines, too early, may be a part of the toxic picture, which almost certainly argues for fewer vaccines delivered with careful attention to the potential for adverse reactions. We do not pretend to know precisely which exposures, in which combination, may have played a role in the current rise in autism rates. Possible suspects include sources of mercury from power plants and fish consumption, and other toxins as well, from chemicals in plastic baby bottles to those that are found in pajamas. But we do believe mercury, and that certainly includes the ethyl mercury in vaccines, was present at the creation, when the disease first emerged, and continues to be a major player as autism rates have surged over the last two decades. And we believe uncovering autism's historical roots leaves no doubt as to its origin and nature. Autism is man-made. Informed by this simple truth, we can stop triggering autism and start treating it for what it is, and we can learn lessons that may help crack the code of other modern plagues, from Alzheimer's and Parkinson's to asthma and Lou Gehrig's disease. We believe these possibilities are cause for hope. Doctors have been using mercury in an attempt to heal since antiquity. The Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, Arabs, and Chinese put it to a whole range of uses. In Western medicine, it was used mainly to treat the skin lesions of lepers and balance the humors. The demand for mercury in medicine as a pigment and in alchemy spurred a mining industry that stretches back to the Roman Empire and the mines of Almaden in Spain and Idria in Slovenia. For just as long, miners have been getting poisoned. In fact, the Romans sent convict laborers into the mines as a death sentence. Mercury use became more widespread with the epidemic of syphilis in Europe, but even then, little changed in the commonly prescribed forms for centuries. Doctors worked with mercury mostly in its metallic form, in rubs and vapors, and applied it to the skin, where it had undeniable effects in killing both the syphilis and leprosy bacteria. Convinced that mercury was the essential weapon in the armory of any practicing physician, enterprising apothecaries soon began experimenting with new mercury compounds and ways to deliver them, not just on the surface. Chloride compounds of mercury, mercurous, and mercuric were easiest to synthesize from the base metal and became the most widely used formulations. Also, starting in the 18th century, Viennese physicians began experimenting with internal administration. The idea was simple: deliver a more powerful form of the poison more directly to the source of the disease process. Instead of the skin, go straight to the diseased organ. Instead of an ointment that requires absorption and evaporation, develop a more targeted, toxic dose of a manufactured compound. This made mercury compounds the original chemotherapy, the first synthesized pharmaceutical substance with a specific chemical mission: to reach and eliminate the source of disease. During all this innovation, concern about mercury's impact on human health was never far from the surface, but its use in medicine continued to spread. In 1807, the New Encyclopedia reported a case that echoes the infamous Vietnam-era statement about destroying a village in order to save it. The particulars of this case we need not quote, as the patient, a child at the breast, aged 7 months, though cured of the hydrocephalus by a mercurial course of 7 days, died on the 8th, about 8 p.m. The article cites a Dr. Percival as blaming the powerful action of the mercury. While mercury intoxication is often linked in the popular imagination to the stereotypical tremors and distorted thinking of Mad Hatter's disease, symptoms can vary from subtle personality changes to vision problems, to muscle contractions and paralysis, to unbearable intestinal pains, euphemistically labeled as gastric crises, to death. Mercury is the great pretender, mimicking many diseases and their symptoms: the tremors of Parkinson's, the hallucinations of schizophrenia, the paralysis and contractures of stroke, the gastrointestinal pain of ulcers and cancers. Even when patients are given the same dose of the same mercury compound, the effects in different cases can be totally idiosyncratic and unpredictable. In pink disease, for instance, only 1 in 500 children treated with teething powders succumbed to the illness. No wonder it took 2 decades and the development of new instruments to measure, supposedly, trace amounts of mercury to connect the two. But the heart of the problem in recognizing mercury poisoning is latency. For reasons still unknown, there can be a long time lag, days, weeks, months, even decades between a mercury exposure and the manifestation of its ill effects. The benefits of mercury were always clear. When it was rubbed on a skin lesion, the sore would disappear. The risks of the medicine were often far subtler and almost always delayed. For the physician, dedicated to his mission of combating disease, the temptation to ignore the delayed effects of the favored therapeutic was often overwhelming. The negative consequences were mysterious, difficult to trace, and easy to pin to other factors, especially the illness itself. This skewed combination of risk and benefit has made mercury controversial throughout the history of modern medicine. In August 1996, Dartmouth chemistry professor Karen Waterhan, a toxicologist who was working on understanding how chemicals like mercury and chromium might cause cancer, had donned goggles, lab coat, and gloves to work with a small vial of dimethylmercury. Dimethylmercury was invented in 1854 as part of the ongoing quest for more potent forms of mercurial medicine that could be delivered at smaller concentrations. Wetterhahn, a star of the chemistry department at Dartmouth, and recipient of many prestigious grants from the National Institutes of Health, thought she knew the risks. She used state-of-the-art protection. She wore latex gloves and carefully handled the vial underneath a chemical fume hood that blew vapors away from her. But the contents of the vial, 3 or 4 drops, about the weight of a small paperclip, accidentally spilled, and within seconds they had penetrated the protective layer of latex and begun working their way through her skin. For many weeks thereafter it was as if nothing had happened. She continued with her normal duties and soon forgot the accident under the lab hood. Then, slowly, she began to notice subtle signs of illness that she still did not connect to the incident. Eventually, the symptoms became progressively more serious. A full 5 months later, she was finally admitted to the hospital, suffering from mental confusion, balance problems, and loss of appetite. It was only then, after doctors ran a standard panel of tests, that a surprising result jumped off the page. Mercury levels that were off the chart. Despite efforts to remove the mercury chemically through a process called chelation, her symptoms evolved quickly, and she was in a coma when she died in June 1997, 10 months after the exposure. Luckily, dimethylmercury is secured behind locked doors in no more than 100 laboratories around the world. But the mercury we need to pay attention to right now faces no such barriers. It beats 4 main paths to our door. 1. Natural emissions. These predate human civilization and include natural events such as volcanoes and forest fires. These emissions are part of the background level of mercury that has always been with us. As humans, we've developed methods to detoxify these low levels of exposure. The body has built-in defenses. Molecules like glutathione and other natural chelators that filter out the mercury reaching us in our water, air, and food. These defenses usually permit us to deal with natural mercury exposures just fine. 2. Industrial emissions. With the Industrial Revolution has come an onslaught of new forms of mercury. These include emissions from specialized industrial processes used in chlorine plants, mirror and hat-making facilities, and cement factories. But the single largest source of mercury is from coal, and thus integrally linked to the fossil fuel-based economy that has led to climate change concerns and widespread alarms over rising carbon dioxide levels. As this new wave of man-made or anthropogenic mercury is released in the environment, it finds its way into the food chain through numerous paths. Most prominently, when bacteria in marshes and rivers convert inorganic mercury from these emissions into a more neurotoxic form called methylmercury. As the toxin passes from prey to predator up the food chain, its concentration is magnified. By the time we eat tuna, we are ingesting one of the most concentrated storehouses of mercury in the world. 3. Manufactured chemicals. The active properties of mercury have long made it an attractive element for chemical companies in synthesizing commercial products, especially pesticides. Mercury exposure from these sources has been at the root of some of the most infamous disasters in the history of 20th century industrial manufacturing. Although much has been done to reduce or eliminate these exposures, mercury is still in demand for targeted applications, from fluorescent light bulbs to computer screens. 4. Medicinal sources. While we've removed the gross, high-volume, low-toxicity forms of mercury from medicine, the march of progress has led to its use as an antibacterial agent in many medicines and as fillings in teeth. The controversy continues. Ethyl mercury was removed from some vaccines beginning in 1999 after federal officials became alarmed at the total amount an infant could receive by the age of 2. But the economic advantages of mercury still propel its use. Dentists around the world regularly place silver fillings, which are actually amalgams of mercury, tin, and nickel, into the mouths of millions. And all over the globe, ethyl mercury remains in regular childhood immunizations for diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, hepatitis B, and influenza. In the United States, the much-publicized fear of bird and swine flu epidemics has been used to excuse the continued presence of mercury in millions of doses of influenza vaccine administered to pregnant women and infant children. As influenza vaccine coverage has risen, the toxic effect of these early exposures has increased, even as the doses from other vaccines have fallen. And in the meantime, substitute chemicals have emerged to perform part of ethyl mercury's function in vaccines, including new preservatives to prevent bacterial growth in multi-dose vials, and new adjuvants or immune stimulants such as aluminum, another highly toxic metal. Understanding the composition of mercury, as well as what makes it different from other substances, will help make sense of what follows. Mercury is an atom, number 80 out of the 118 currently displayed on the periodic table of elements. Designated Hg, it is a relatively heavy atom, lying close to gold, lead, and platinum on the sixth row of the periodic table. This gives it some strange and not always wonderful properties, properties that are captured in the colloquial usage of the word mercurial to mean volatile, erratic, unstable, or changeable in temperament. Although we may be tempted to think of mercury as a singular element, in fact, its behavior and properties vary quite widely, depending on the specific chemical form it takes. In its most basic form, mercury is described as elemental or metallic mercury. This type is stable and doesn't react much with surrounding molecules. For anyone who remembers playing with a broken thermometer, the mercury you then encountered displayed some of the element's unusual properties. Metallic mercury is liquid at room temperature. A relatively stable configuration of electrons discourages it from binding or dissolving into other substances, which explains why some people are capable of swallowing even large amounts of metallic mercury without suffering ill effects. Miners who refine liquid mercury are often known to play parlor games with outsiders. A National Geographic article from 1972 entitled "Quicksilver and Slow Death" shows a veteran miner in street clothes floating with no part of his body below the surface on top of a vat of pure liquid mercury. Its density, 13.5 times that of water, so great that it can support the weight of a fully grown man. Writers have long commented on quicksilver's peculiarities. And then there is mercury, arguably the barmiest of all the elements, writes Natalie Angier in The Canon, A Layman's Guide to Science. Mercury is liquid at room temperature, and it conducts heat and electricity so poorly that it barely merits inclusion in metaldom. Behind mercury's unusual behavior are its massive nucleus and the strong pull of its 80 protons. The positive packet at mercury's core keeps such a powerful lock on all the surrounding electrons that, even though the element theoretically has two negative particles to share in an electron sea, those electrons prefer staying close to their nuclear family, leaving the metallic bonds linking one mercury atom to another weak and easily disrupted. Because of its weight and well-known reputation for toxicity, mercury has helped define a common term for toxic substances, heavy metals, a category that strikes fear into the hearts of many and also includes lead, arsenic, and cadmium. But the fact that mercury is heavy and barely a metal actually provides little guidance as to its toxic effects. Many heavy elements are non-toxic. Bismuth, the heaviest stable element, heavier than mercury, is the active ingredient in Pepto-Bismol. And since the vast majority of elements on the periodic table are classified as metals or metalloids, it's hard to see what being a heavy metal has to do with anything. Toxicologist John Duffus has argued that it's time to get rid of the term heavy metal, a phrase he derides as a meaningless term. But understanding why mercury is so highly toxic requires some explanation of why mercury interacts in the way it does with other atoms, in molecular combinations, and in living things. According to Duffus, getting closer to an understanding of the toxic properties of certain metals requires us to go deeper into the intrinsic character of these substances. Duffus doesn't formalize such a classification, but he offers some suggestions on how to do so. And his reasoning leads us away from the properties of metallic mercury, the least interesting form of mercury in terms of toxicity, and instead toward considering mercury in its reactive, positively charged form, which is typically described as inorganic mercury. Inorganic mercury is perhaps best defined in contrast to its opposite, organic mercury, which is any mercury compound that contains carbon atoms. By definition, neither metallic mercury nor inorganic mercury compounds contain carbon. When one or two of the outermost electrons orbiting a mercury atom are stripped off, mercury enters its reactive form, Hg positive or Hg double positive. In this state, it becomes capable of accepting electrons from other donor atoms and forming larger molecular combinations. And in such combinations lie mercury's particular toxicity. Mercury has long been known to react selectively with certain substances, such as sulfur and iodine. University of California chemist Ralph Pearson, observing mercury's binding propensities, developed a chemical theory around it, one that relied on the natural affinity of acids, electron donors, and bases, electron acceptors. Specifically, he suggested that some substances were chemically soft, while others were hard. Mercury species like Hg double positive are, according to Pearson, the classic soft acid. What makes mercury chemically soft? In its reactive states, mercury has a large atomic radius, one that is easily distorted by the electrical fields of nearby molecules. That tendency for distortion, what chemists call polarizability, is basically what makes it soft and attractive to its necessary partners in reactions, the soft bases such as sulfur and chlorine. And those bonds between soft acids and soft bases, observed Pearson, wind up being particularly strong. What seems certain from Pearson's analysis is that soft is dangerous, at least as far as mercury goes, because it's not only inorganic mercury that's soft. It's also the organic mercury forms, most prominently methyl mercury, that react strongly with soft bases as well. As we noted previously, organic compounds such as ethyl and methyl mercury are defined by the presence of one or more carbon atoms in the molecule. And both play a role in the chemical reactions that make mercury especially dangerous, those that take place in living organisms. The ability of both inorganic and organic mercury to bind to sulfur groups means that they find ways to bind in vivo to the amino acid known as cysteine, an important structural and functional component of many proteins and enzymes. As machines are to a factory, so enzymes are to the metabolism. They cut up chemical compounds, assemble them, twist and bind them. And while biologists speak of these enzymes as strings of amino acids, the outputs of the code in our DNA, they are more than strings in real life. In a living cell, they're actually nanoscopic, three-dimensional machinery. In building that machinery, the sulfur atom plays a special role. In a long amino acid chain, sulfur atoms connect at different points to one another, building disulfide bridges that give certain enzymes their three-dimensional shape. Interfering with those bridges is like throwing sand in the gears of a machine. They won't work the way they're supposed to. Of all the toxic substances you can throw into the body, the reactive forms of mercury have a specific capacity to disrupt these disulfide bridges. Based on our research, autism is only the latest mystery illness with a not-so-mysterious link to mercury. While mainstream medical groups and public health officials remain resolutely baffled, even questioning whether the disorder is increasing, autism has become a modern plague. In the United States, the estimates of the number of affected children rise continually, going from 1 in 10,000 in the 1960s and 1970s to 1 in 100 today. In some states, the rate has risen to more than 1% of children and nearly 2% of boys. Autism affects boys at about 4 times the rate of girls. Contrary to calming assurances of some who see autism as a natural part of the human condition, most families affected by autism experience the disease as serious and disabling. Children affected with autism will require special services and, in most cases, lifelong care. While rarely fatal itself, an autistic condition puts children at far greater risk of accidental death, most frequently in the form of drowning. Autistic children have an affinity for the water even when they can't swim. When faced with the prospects of dealing with a lifetime of daily disruption and duties, parents often get overwhelmed and look to a future with no relief in sight. For those who find a way to adapt their lives and purpose to support their disabled son or daughter, the greatest fear is their child's inability to live independently. What will happen when I die? Worries every parent of an autistic child. Within the larger picture, we have come to see autism as a leading indicator. As we increasingly saturate our environment and food supply with mercury and other toxins, and run uncontrolled medical experiments on children, including but not limited to the injection of mercury, the latest generation born in the developed world may be the sickest in our memory. They are not sick in the sense of the infectious disease epidemics of the great cities such as cholera, typhoid, and diphtheria, but sick in ways the modern medical profession has been slow to recognize and unable to explain. One child in six with a developmental disorder ranging from ADD to autism. Children dropping dead with even the slightest exposure to peanuts. Nearly 1 in 10 with asthma, leading to schools filled with special ed classes, EpiPens, and inhalers. Summer camp, which used to be a break from and for the parents, is now an experience accompanied by professional staff to administer multiple medications. The rise of deficits in attention, hyperactivity, depression, and bipolar illness has made children a new target for psychotropic drugs, all of them palliative, and none of them addressing the root question. Why are so many children sick? We contend that to answer this question, medical science needs to embrace a new model of disease. The first convincing formulations of germ theory by Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur ushered medicine out of the Dark Ages, providing a deeper understanding for a whole range of illnesses caused by microorganisms that had previously been explained through the superstitious theory of the humors. James D. Watson and Francis Crick's discovery of DNA sparked a new wave of hope for understanding illness according to an inheritance model of disease. Unfortunately, as analyses of the genetic profiles of victims of autism and other chronic diseases have shown, genetics alone has failed to provide a comparably satisfying answer for this latest wave of chronic diseases of advanced civilization. In what follows, we describe a range of potential disease models. Could some autism cases be a simple matter of undiagnosed mercury poisoning, like acrodynia, or some cases of hysteria, or the outcome of well-meaning but dangerous medical treatments, perhaps the interaction between mercury and a microbe? Or is the situation worse than that? A complex mix of genetic susceptibility, toxic chemistry, and poorly understood events in childhood? We offer a series of new explanations for specific diseases, each of which we have traced to common roots in the use of medicinal mercury and industrial mercury exposure. We do not provide a definitive answer to the autism puzzle. We do, however, believe we are pointing in the right direction. It has no doubt occurred to you, who are these authors and what is the research they refer to? One of us, a father of a child with autism, is a business professional skilled in statistical analysis who has contributed peer-reviewed scientific articles on the prevalence of autism and its association with mercury exposure. The other is a journalist who has written widely on autism, mental health issues, and the dangerous side effects of prescription drugs. Our ideas and discoveries have grown out of several years of collaboration, each of us contributing to a bigger picture than either saw alone. Aspects of our argument have been proposed before. David Kirby's award-winning book, Evidence of Harm, chronicled how parents themselves first connected the rise in mercury exposure via vaccines with the explosion of autism cases starting in 1990. But our historical sweep and geographic scope is both more ambitious and inevitably more speculative. We are seeking to collect the truth from circumstances and little collateral facts, as Judge Buller advised in 1781, and let you render a verdict. Historical epidemiology, another term for this approach, may be one of the few fields of science open to all. We set out to establish a fresh reading of the medical literature, and it really is literature, an epic narrative with great characters and high drama, uninfluenced by received wisdom, conflicts of interest, or fear of ridicule. We also possess a sense of urgency and purpose, and a belief that our discoveries can help reshape the public discussion of autism and other environmental illnesses. Such a discussion is long overdue. Nearly 140 years before Karen Wetterhahn's death at Dartmouth, a Scottish woman named Elizabeth Story wrote about her own mercury poisoning at the hands of a doctor. Story was treated for a minor childhood skin ailment, nettle rush, which today would probably be diagnosed as hives, an allergic reaction. The doctor, a friend of the family who had just begun practicing medicine, stopped by and found Elizabeth ill. He offered to send up a few powders that would do me good. This concoction contained calomel, mercurous chloride, according to her later book, The Autobiography of Elizabeth Story. My head began to swell to a great extent, and saliva to flow in large quantities from my mouth. Salivation is a sure sign of an overdose, though often it was considered beneficial under the theory of humors. As the doctor kept helping, Elizabeth just got worse. Her gums turned to mush, her teeth fell out, her jaws fused. Her health never recovered. For the rest of her life, she had to take nourishment, such as it was, through a straw. The medical establishment of the time denied responsibility for this blatant malpractice, and judges refused to enforce the £1,000 verdict she won against her doctor. But she remained undaunted. The facts which will be brought to light may also serve to warn those in high power of the danger of doing injustice or injury to any, trusting that, through the insignificance of their victims, the world may never know how much they have made others to suffer. I can offer nothing attractive to the reader of this book except the truthfulness of the statements made therein. The victims of disease are far more than just statistics on paper. They have names and faces. Their suffering is real, and should never be lost in the search for scientific proof. Truth matters, and denial of an injury that produces suffering, whether direct or indirect, dishonors the victims and puts future generations at risk. Our discoveries, we hope, will honor the suffering that has gone before, as it helps the truth emerge.